Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I'm contributing writer Dan Ahern. The time you are listening to this podcast, it will at least be Friday, September 1st, and we usually do the recruiting podcasts on Fridays. But since it is September 1st, which is the first date where college coaches can contact players in the class of 2019, we thought it was redundant to have a recruiting podcast that could be outdated by the time it aired, and instead chose to absorb all the developments of the opening of the contact period throughout the weekend and deliver a podcast reacting to all of that sometime next week. So stay tuned for that. Instead, this week, we're going to have a little fun and go pretty off-topic. Back during the college season, we had Anish Shroff on the In the Crease podcast to talk his prediction for Game of Thrones Season 7. Now that we're beyond that, I caught up with Anish to absorb his thoughts on the most recent season and get his predictions going forward. Obviously, it goes without saying, this podcast will contain spoilers concerning Game of Thrones Season 7 and before. Anish, welcome on, man.
Let's talk a little Game of Thrones.
We're about 4 days removed from the finale. 7 episodes, quite the bang, the final two. What was your overall reaction to this season? Were you satisfied? Did you feel like it was a really strong season? Are you excited?
I was a little miffed at, let's call them, some of the mixed reviews that I've seen. You know, it's kind of people worrying about timelines and the speed of crows and the speed of dragons in a show that's, let's face it, about now zombies and dragons and now ice dragons. And this was always a fantasy trope. What made it unique was the characters on the show sort of treated the fantasy element the way we did at home, where, you know, we sort of suspend our belief a little bit. And a lot of the characters on the show really didn't want to acknowledge that these mystical and mythical and fantastical elements existed for a long time. Well, now they do. And, you know, in the later stages of the show, it's become more of a fantasy than it was, you know, in the first few seasons, where it probably felt more like The Sopranos and The Wire. And you're at the point now where action is going to drive the show. Did some of it feel rushed? Okay, sure. Were some of the plot holes, were some of the plot points, maybe not as bulletproof as before. I'll buy that. But at the end of the day, we're talking about a show of dragons and zombies. And for me, it was immensely entertaining.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I just kind of felt like there were some things that, you know, kind of, you know, drew my eye. I was like, how is that plausible? But that kind of leads me very, very well into my next question. The show came under heavy flack at several points during the season for the writing, and I know that was extremely apparent in episode 6 when we have this somewhat plausible storyline where Gendry runs back to the wall, gets a raven to Daenerys. Daenerys comes with her dragons north of the wall, saves Jon. And not only that, that's not only the first, so to speak, deus ex machina of that episode, but then once Jon is left,
Yeah. He
comes out of the water and is saved by his uncle Benjen. It was probably the greatest deus ex machina of all time. But this leads me to my question. Is the show beyond criticism now? I feel like the emotional investment is so high that we're willing to bend so much more than we ever have.
Are we bending the knee to Benioff and Weiss? It appears, perhaps. You know, I look at it this way. The source material from which they based the early seasons of the show on, really the first 5 seasons, was so incredibly rich and so incredibly layered, all the stuff that George R. R. Martin come up with. Well, now the show has moved beyond the book, so now the TV producers and the TV writers have more leeway to sort of direct the direction of the show. And what made the first few seasons, I think what you mentioned about getting emotionally invested in these characters, is that there was this reality that your favorite character could die. Well, you know, your God of the Machine reference, I mean, we've seen that so many times with our favorite characters now. Every time, it seems they get bailed out, and they don't die anymore. And, you know, what's the last time we've really had a shocking death of characters that we really cared about? I'm not talking about, you know, losing a Littlefinger, or when Cersei blew up the Sept of Baelor, you had a lot of significant characters, but none that you had this emotional investment in. Yeah, I think that may have disappointed a few people. I mean, I looked at season seven, I thought, okay, at the very beginning, there's no way that Cersei and Jaime make it alive. And certainly there's a, an emotional aftershock that comes with losing one of those characters, but both of them were able to survive. But, you know, you told me that you thought there's a chance, I think maybe it was you, somebody told me, maybe Tyrion, could die. And again, you know, that's along the lines of, you know, losing a Ned Stark and you know, for a brief moment, losing a Jon Snow, the Red Wedding, things like that. So we haven't seen as much of that. And I think that's where some of the criticism comes from. It's like, okay, you know, now instead of shocking us, now instead of taking away one of our favorite characters, it's the, you know, the Deus Ex Machina sort of effect where they're saved at the last minute.
We left off season six. The final scene is Daenerys sailing with the Unsullied, with her dragons, with the Dothraki screamers towards Westeros, setting up what is undoubtedly the climactic narrative of the whole story. But episode one of season seven opens with that Arya scene where she basically takes the face. Walder Frey slaughters the entire Frey house with poison in one of the most badass scenes ever. What was your reaction to that?
Well, it shows you who Arya's become, right? I mean, that was the cool part. You start to see, you know, before she had this list and she would mutter these names before going to bed every night. And now finally it's all right. I'm going to start acting on more than a few of these names. You know, I've seen a couple of names get crossed off, but, Walder Frey, I mean, it was nice to see the Red Wedding avenged. And, I thought it was also an insight into who Arya has become, you know, cause we see her kill Walder Frey at the end of what was it? Season six. Right. And then the beginning of season seven, she murders the whole family. And didn't you get the sense that, okay, you know, she has viscerally changed? I mean, you look at her the first few seasons, I mean, that innocence has been completely stripped away.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, that's kind of the point of that whole scene. I think it's in episode two or three where, you know, Sansa and Littlefinger are overlooking her fight Brienne of Tarth, and she's giving Brienne a hard time, and it's just like, What has Arya been through? Like, that was another thing that kind of like kept coming up throughout the story in this season was like, could Arya handle what Sansa went through, and could Sansa, you know, handle what Arya went through? I was like, they're very awful things, both of those things happening to them. But I was like, we emotionally invested like two seasons of Arya, like being blind, like being poor, like getting her ass beat by this random blonde girl who like,
and you're wondering why
yeah,
the whole time.
And then in that final scene, you know, kind of to come back to episode seven where she's about to be put on trial, I was like, man, I did not invest all that time, all that pain in this very questionable storyline to kind of see her just get killed off by Sansa.
Well, you know, and we can get into that when we talk about what's after this series. And I think to me, you know, the final season, I think the main thematic plot point, if all the foreshadowing used to be believed, is allegiance. But, you know, I looked at that and you look at the two sisters and you look at the Stark family. I think I tweeted after the show. I said, you know, hey, it's finally nice. Those SAT prep courses are paying off because, listen, the Starks have made some idiotic decisions through the course of the show. And it was kind of nice where, you know, Arya got this training to be this savvy, stealthy, faceless person. Sansa being around the likes of a Cersei, being around the likes of a Littlefinger, being around the sadistic Ramsay Bolton, you know, was, again, stripped of her naivete. And all of a sudden, you know, kind of has this bigger insight into human nature and how people function and what drives them. And you actually see these Starks evolve. And it's finally nice to see Bran actually do something, you know, while the sisters were sort of fighting and not getting along, or, you know, however we were meant to believe that, you know, he's kind of sitting in the corner, sitting by the tree, you know, in full emo mode. So it was nice that, you know, the guy who's got unfiltered access to the truth actually decides to act on that a little bit and step in and, you know, bridge the gap between the two of his sisters and actually identify the real enemy.
Also in that first episode, to kind of bring it back around, That was when Arya, you know, going north of the wall, going south at this point, meets the group of Lannister soldiers, which includes a cameo.
Oh, no, yeah.
Yeah. What was your?
Why did people make such? I had no reaction to it. Why did people make such a big deal out of it? He had Noah Syndergaard, and a few episodes later, he had Ed Sheeran. Big deal. Who cares? He had like three lines. That's faux internet. That scene was made for faux internet outrage. That's what it was. You know, people just like to be angry about stuff. Oh, why'd they have him on the show? Who cares?
Yeah.
I mean, it was a throwaway scene in a lot of ways.
Like, I was really thrown aback when I saw him, and I'll cop to saying that it did, like, throw off the immersion or whatever, but I was like, I'm not going to let this ruin the show, but people are like, no, this is it. I give up. The show is, like, too big now. Celebrities want their cameos on the show. I'm over it. I'm like, come on, man. It's Ed Sheeran, like, singing for 5 seconds.
Right. If one scene with Ed Sheeran is going to ruin the show for you, then, again, you're part of this culture that likes to be outraged because, I don't know, maybe it satisfies some deep down darkness within you. But I said, really, if a 5 minute scene or a 2 minute scene, whatever it was, with Ed Sheeran, where he's got a handful of lines, if that ruined the entire series for you, then you probably weren't a fan. I just, you know, to me, that's okay. It's made for, you know, the fake outrage culture that we live in.
Next storyline we should discuss, kind of a new setting that was introduced to us with the Citadel and Samwell going there, kind of having his own little Rocky montage with the soup bowls and the poop bowls. But we also find out that Jorah is there, kind of looking for his cure for grayscale.
Yeah, that was interesting. And it was nice to see those two characters come together. To me, Samwell, I think he's going to play a significant role in the end. And that's sort of been foreshadowed. And, you know, what I really like about, you know, kind of where we are in the show now, you look at where some of these characters have come from, you know, Arya from, you know, the self-imposed exile to Braavos to now being the stealthy assassin and one of the guardians of Winterfell, Sansa being all she's gone through from, you know, this naive little girl who's, you know, played like a pawn by those in power. Now she's the one in power and she's the one moving the chess pieces. And Samwell, you know, remember he was the, you know, kind of, even though he was a legitimate son, he was treated almost as a bastard in his own family because, you know, he lacked maybe a certain masculinity that his father demanded. And now he's the guy with the knowledge and he's the guy who, you know, ultimately might have some of the tools and some of the information to save the world. And, you know, you kind of seeing these characters sort of from these very humble beginnings, not expecting much in the beginning, to now they're a point where they're not just game changers, but they're the people that you're looking at to rely on to potentially save humanity.
Moving on to episode two, the really kind of a whole bunch of other plot points, but the main kind of crux of the episode is this ambush by good old Rockstar Euron of the Greyjoy fleet that is sailing to Sunspear and Casterly Rock, I believe. They get ambushed. Yara gets captured by Euron, and Theon literally jumps ship. He's like, I'm out. Peace. Reactions to that, because that was kind of like it was a slow-moving episode, and then all of a sudden, boom.
All right, so full-on confession here. I was rooting for Euron to end the Dornish storyline. let's face it. Can we admit that was probably the biggest mistake of the show when they, you know, introduced this Dornish plot? It just really never materialized to that much. And, you know, let's give Euron some props for putting an end to the Dornish line.
Absolutely. Like, it's just so funny how kind of apparent it is that they're so desperate to kind of kill off this storyline. Like, at the end of last season, they kill off Dorne Martell. Kind of like, just like very unceremoniously, like, oh yeah, by the way, I'm going to betray you right here, right now. You're dead. And then kind of just out of nowhere, right, this ambush that could have easily have been, you know, kind of prevented by scouting or just, you know, sending a ship into the distance and kind of just looking for, you know, pirates or, you know, maybe the entire Lannister fleet. But the desperation to kill off that is actually comical in some sense.
Yeah, and to me, they weren't well-developed characters. They were introduced, I think, probably a little late on the show for anybody to get any emotional attachment to them. And then, I mean, I'm not going to, you know, jump on any of the actors, but, I mean, let's face it, the reality was the acting, you know, for those Dornish characters, it was cartoonish.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Sand Snakes, Alaria, you know, nothing on screen that you said, oh, yeah, you know, these are people that I'm rooting for. You know, I wondered, you know, I mean, I've read the books, and the books, I think the plot is at least a little more intriguing. They've got a couple of more characters, and you know, the character of Prince Doron Martell, you know, the one who was you know, in the chair and then was fatally stabbed and killed by the Sand Snakes. You know, in the book, he's kind of this very laid back but calculating figure. Sort of, you know, counting 12 steps ahead, and you're wondering what his end game is, and you're just a little more invested. It was so rushed on the show that those characters were never fully hashed out. And so, you know, props to Euron, not the most likable guy in the world, but, you know, whenever Euron's time is done, and his time will probably be done soon on the show, he did one good thing. He took out Dorne.
You know, as a book reader, definitely agree. The storylines and the characters are so much more rich when it comes to the Martells in the books. It's kind of a disappointment in a way to see them botch that storyline. One of the best parts about reading the Game of Thrones books is reading the intricate descriptions of all the food that is getting cooked in the Seven Kingdoms. It gets me pretty hungry, so now I'm looking forward to going home and whipping up some Blue Apron that Raven brought. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron has great variety. Choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. It's also easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Some of the upcoming featured meals include summer vegetables and egg paninis with Calabrian chili mayonnaise and caprese salad, soy-glazed pork and rice cakes with bok choy and marinated green beans, skillet vegetable chili with cornmeal and cheddar drop biscuits, and garlic butter shrimp with corn, green beans, salad, and roasted purple tomatoes. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/lacrosse. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/lacrosse. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Moving on, though, to the third episode, really kind of one of the hallmark moments of the entire season, really of the entire show, with Jon coming to Dragonstone and finally meeting the Dragon Queen, Daenerys. They kind of have a tense early first meeting.
Well, you know what? I got to be honest. Danny, the whole God complex, it's getting to be a little much, and I'm curious to see how all that's going to reconcile itself when she learns that, yeah, the guy who just bent the knee to her is actually further along in the line of succession. But yeah, she's become a little more insufferable the more she's accumulated wealth and power and these bigger armies and these bigger dragons. And I found it really hard to root for her.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about the whole season, to kind of encapsulate it real quick, is that the characters kind of storylines weren't, and their development weren't linear. You kind of, you know, you went one episode loving a character, and then you spent the next maybe one or two episodes hating them. And they kind of have an arc that is, you know, kind of up and down, a little shaky. And she was definitely one of them, and I actually think it was a bigger theme of the whole season to kind of see her get grounded, essentially. She was humbled by Jon, kind of his unselfishness. And then she kind of just gets humbled by her armies getting beat, her dragon getting killed. It was just a really interesting kind of arc for her this season.
It was. And again, you know, maybe that has to do with stepping into power, but it's still, she is power hungry and she is power obsessed. And, you know, her motivations are still to, you know, to sit on that Iron Throne. You know, I'm not sure that she sees the game and she sees the picture like Jon does. You know, Jon kind of is looking at it and saying, hey, man, you know, I don't think John really cares about who rules and who leads. For John, it's, hey, I have to do what's best for the people that put their faith in me.
Absolutely. Moving on to the fourth episode. This was it, man. This was the episode of the entire season. The Spoils of War. Do we really even got to talk about anything else besides the Field of Fire? I mean, come on. That was everything we've been waiting for on this show. For, you know, for some people, it's been like 21 years. The 1996 original Game of Thrones book readers were like, oh, man, this was it. This was the payoff. For us, you know, it's been 7 years. We've kind of been waiting for this moment. Go through it.
It's kind of like, hey, let's get it. We're going to go full drone out here. I mean, that was, I just think from a pure exhilaration standpoint, that was as good as the show can be in terms of an action sequence. And what made it so great was you had characters on both sides you care about. You know, I mean, we've invested in Dany since the very beginning, since she was sold to the Dothraki, and we saw these dragons hatch, and we wondered what they could become. And now you're seeing, you know, a full-grown 747 just, I mean, unleashing fire on this Lannister army. And then on the other side, you know, Jaime, who, again, we didn't like him very much in the first season, he has sort of morphed into the tragic hero. And I think a lot of us, I mean, I know I am, I'm rooting for his redemption. And you, I mean, we've seen when he's away from his sister, he's a good dude. He means well. And there's a lot of nobility, and there's his moral compass is intact. And we're kind of sitting there like, wait a minute. I mean, is this going to be the end of a character that we've invested in? And I think that's what made that battle unique compared to maybe a battle where you have like the Battle of the Bastards, where you're clearly rooting for one side, where Hardhome, you know, against the White Walkers, you clearly have rooting interest. Here, you know, you're torn. And I think that's what made that scene so powerful.
Absolutely. And that scene was also kind of prescient because it's contrasted against kind of this overall theme of, is Daenerys going to be a good and just queen? And she basically comes with her dragon, comes with her horde of foreign Dothraki invaders, and kind of just goes to town on this Lannister army, absolutely slaughtering them. And you can kind of see when Tyrion is watching from the side of the battle, he's like, what have I done? What have I unleashed on, you know, my home, like the Seven Kingdoms? This is...
There's a theory out there that she might be the ultimate villain. Do you buy that?
Possibly. I mean, there's so many theories about, you know, characters. Like, we've all heard this kind of theory that Bran is the Night King, and maybe the Night King is a good guy. Maybe he's coming south to stop somebody. Maybe it's Dany. Maybe it's Jon. Maybe it's Bran. Who knows? Like, I feel like going into the final season, we have these clear cut, oh, like, this person is a good person, but we might, you know, get flipped on that and say, oh my gosh, this person is actually horrible.
You know, I disagree.
I don't buy Dany being a villain.
I disagree with that to some degree, because I look at the Night King and I look at that whole story arc. That's, to me, the only one-dimensional story arc we have in the show, where they have been portrayed as clearly evil, clearly wrong, this mindless killing machine. But if you look at the show, no other element in the show is that one-dimensional. Everything else is shaded gray. And so I wonder, you know, is there a red herring in play of sorts where we still don't know what their ultimate motive is? We don't know what the White Walker's motive is. We don't know why they're doing this. And I feel that has to be revealed at some point, and the answer could potentially shock us. I mean, I have a theory that maybe it's sort of this natural, supernatural element put in place to reset humanity in a lot of ways. And, you know, is what the Night King doing any worse than what Cersei Lannister has done? Where, you know, she's tried to have her brother killed, and she blew up the Baelor, and she's done all sorts of atrocities, and other characters on the show have done all sorts of terrible things. Maybe there's another purpose. I'm very curious to see how that pays out, how that pays off, and how that plays out. Because given everything else in the show, I don't buy, you know, that this White Walker army is sort of this one-dimensional pure evilness that they've been portrayed as. I think there's something more there.
Yeah, well, that's something I actually want to address at the end of the show, because I do think that is one of the big questions going forward. But let's get on to Eastwatch, the fifth episode of the season. you know, Jaime and Bronn kind of come out of the lake after the battle. Somehow they just kind of swim 100 yards with 100 pounds of armor on them and kind of just emerge from the water unscathed.
Yeah, who knew? Jaime was Michael Phelps all along, or Bronn was Michael Phelps. Who knew?
But I think definitely the big point of this episode, which is almost unbelievable, is that Davos and Tyrion kind of smuggle themselves into King's Landing to kind of have a secret rendezvous with Jaime. But the side storyline to that is that Davos goes and finds Gendry, who we find out has been just chilling in King's Landing, not running around Dragonstone in perpetuity.
Yeah, he actually stopped rowing his boat after some time, which that was a great line. Davos, by the way, whoever's writing for Davos this season, kudos. Davos has had some great zingers and some great one-liners. I hope he makes it to the end of the show. They've written him well this series, this season particularly. But I thought it was kind of a little sort of nod to the message boards and Redditors. You know, oh hey, so you're not rowing anymore. It was a cool little moment. But sneaking into King's Landing, coupled with what we saw in the episode after that, was probably more plausible than what we saw in Watchers on the Wall, but or Beyond the Wall. But I'm surprised. But it was, again, like anytime you get, I think, you know, Tyrion with a Jaime or a Bronn in the same room again, those scenes are great.
And this was also the episode in which there's really two more important kind of narratives in this episode. One, Gilly kind of dropping the unbelievable revelation that Rhaegar may have actually been legally married to Lyanna Stark, and then Sam kind of just completely glossing over that in frustration.
Right. Yes. It was just kind of like, dude, listen. And, you know, she's trying to explain to him sort of what we have suspected all along, but adding a little twist to that, then they paid that off in the final episode. And again, maybe it's different for me as somebody who's read the books. If you've read the books, that plot point is alluded to in the very first book. I mean, you walk away from the first book, you know, for those who haven't read the books, in the very first book, Ned keeps having these flashbacks where he's with his sister when she's dying, and you hear these words, promise me, Ned, over and over, and these words keep haunting him. And, you know, you put that and juxtapose that next to Jon Snow. Okay, wait, Ned's the most honorable man in all the land, and he came back with a bastard, and his sister asked him to promise something, and his sister was kidnapped and or raped by Rhaegar Targaryen, or maybe she ran away with him. I mean, you can start to put the pieces together, and it was like, well, maybe she chose to run away with him. Maybe the promise that Ned had to keep was, to protect this kid who is his nephew and not his son. And, you know, because he's the honorable guy, he thought the best path was to raise him as his bastard, even though he wasn't. So that's alluded to. It's not spelled out, but it's alluded to in the very first book. Repeatedly. So, you know, if you've read the books, that wasn't a huge surprise when they revealed it at the end of season six. I don't know. I didn't love the fact that they felt the need to spell it out completely at the end of season seven.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because I was actually this was a point of contention between a few friends of mine, where they're basically saying that they weren't book readers. And I was basically telling them, like, man, we kind of figured this out back in like 97, after like a year of people kind of just like going to town analyzing a Game of Thrones. But a lot of people kind of believe that whole lie that Robert set up, where Rhaegar captured Lyanna and that he raped her and basically started the war or Robert's rebellion because of that. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, no. So I was actually kind of like a moment of clarity that I think was needed for some people. It wasn't needed for me. I know it wasn't needed for you, but I did appreciate that moment. And it was a very much a screaming internally moment because of Sam just completely glossing over it.
Yeah, I think the purpose was, hey, just in case, you know, you were tweeting during the show or you were looking down on your phone or checking a score or what have you. And if you missed anything, we're trying to hammer home the fact Jon Snow is not who you think he is.
This was also the episode in which Littlefinger gets followed by Arya, and it's revealed that Littlefinger could be very well playing Arya, which kind of sets up that whole, like, treasonous plot that Arya may be flirting with. Really interesting in that one. And then also, it's also the episode where the very highly esteemed group of people counseling Daenerys decide that it's a totally great and plausible idea to capture a White Walker and take it to Cersei in King's Landing in order to convince them to... In order to convince them to bring, you know, to unite the Seven Kingdoms against the great threat from the North. I just, like, at that point, I was like, really? That's your plan? Like, even for a show with zombies and dragons, like, that is stupid.
It was incredibly dumb. But again, like I said, Jon Snow, very fortunate that he sucks at dying. I mean, for a lack of a better phrase. And, you know, when he gets killed, he's brought back to life. When he, unsheathes his sword in front of a, galloping horde of bad guys, the next thing you know, his army is behind him and they're there to support him when he's, you know, fighting off these zombies and White Walkers at Hardhome. He's able to survive and get on the boat. I mean, this happens over and over and over again, but, you know, to take a handful of guys, the Magnificent Seven plus, a couple of red shirts to bring a White back to King's Landing. I mean, it seemed like a fool's errand. Sometimes, I wonder, Dany doesn't always make the best decisions either, but at least, she's got the three giant erasers, or I should say two now. But at that point, she has three giant erasers. So when she messes up, it's, hey, I've got an Air Force. You don't. Let me show you my Air Force. John, decision-making is not the best. And I'm starting to get the sense that, maybe that's not all Ned Stark's fault. He got that from his father and his real mother, because they clearly didn't make the best decision either by deciding to elope and run away and starting a war and creating all this tension that is now carried over and spilled into the next generation.
Yeah, great. Really great forethinking, kind of just doing that and setting off 50 years of turmoil within their own hometown. Let's move on to that Beyond the Wall episode. We talked about some of the implausibility of the plot with Gendry kind of just running back to the wall, but this was a great episode, regardless of what you think about that plot point. But Daenerys kind of doing what happened in Attack of the Clones by saving the group of warriors via Air Force.
You didn't just reference a movie that never happened.
That's a whole other podcast discussion, man. I'm sure me and Kyle will have it at some point. But then we kind of see the javelin prowess of the Night King, who decides to just throw an ice spear, killing one of the dragons. And that was just like one of the biggest shock moments, I would say, of the entire series. I was just completely taken aback. The last 30 minutes of that entire episode, I was just hyperventilating. And I was still hyperventilating 30 minutes afterwards.
It was one of those episodes where if you can suspend the belief of how they got there, why they're there, and what they're doing, and just yourself in the midst of the action and get lost in the action, it becomes very enjoyable. You do have to suspend the disbelief a little bit, because it's, wait, why are they doing this? And wait, how did the ravens and how did the dragons get there so fast? I think if you suspend all that and just say, you know what, let me enjoy the action sequences. You're right. The last 30 minutes of that were pure exhilaration. And, when you see them kind of marooned down the island with the White Walker armies, sort of surrounding them. You see the Night King biding his time and waiting. That was something else. And the birth of the Ice Dragon at the end, that was chilling. It was a game changer. We see the payoff at the end when the Night King is, riding the, it was Viserion, right? Viserion was the dragon, whatever we're going to call it now. But, yeah, complete game changer. He now has an Air Force. He can counter the dragon, and that means we're going to get a legitimate dragon fight in season 8.
Yeah, to kind of finish off this episode, though, where did the White Walkers, first of all, get the chains? Is there a Home Depot above north of the wall? And two, I thought that they couldn't swim. I thought that was a plot point established.
Right. That's part of the, again, suspend your belief. It's a show about zombies and dragons. You know why? And people, well, how do the White Walkers get the chains? How do the Ravens get there so fast? Like, okay, you realize, like, we're not watching a show about inner city Baltimore. We're not watching a show about the New Jersey mob scene where things happen on still a linear timeline. There's an element of the supernatural here. So I kind of chalk it up to, yeah, okay, they got chains. I don't know how they got chains. They got chains.
It's funny. I watched Beyond the Wall a second time with my friend who had not seen it yet. And that scene where the Night King resurrects the dragon and his eyes open up blue, in reality, was like probably like 10 seconds, but it felt like a whole minute waiting for that dragon's eyes to open. It was just an incredible scene, an emotional kind of punch. It's just like, wow, like, holy cow, like.
Well, you, I don't know about you. I mean, you saw that coming the moment that dragon goes down. I mean, as soon as that dragon goes down, I'm thinking, okay. And, you know, remember, you know, the Chekhov's gun in that episode was the polar bear, the polar bear that had the blue eyes that was turned into a weapon for the army of the zombies, of the White Walkers that we see in the beginning. This idea that, hey, they can, you know, turn these ferocious beasts into these mindless killing machines and come after people. That was, you know, that was Chekhov's gun. You know, you set that in Act One, you pay it off in Act Three, and in Act Three, it's the dragon, which is a little more frightening than a polar bear. So, you know, they did foreshadow that a little bit. So as soon as that dragon went down, the first thought that crossed my mind was, oh man, is he gonna get a dragon? I mean, is this, you know, the Night King, How to Train Your Dragon, and apparently it was.
Yeah, and another point is that it was clear that the Walkers had game planned, you know, for a dragon attack. They had these spears and that they had this ability to throw them. And it kind of almost felt like,
I don't know if they game planned it, because, you know, the dragons kind of came out of nowhere, but I'll say this, hell of a halftime adjustment.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you know what? We actually have a counter for this.
That's great coaching.
That kind of leads into the idea that maybe it was a trap set by the Walkers, because with a dragon, they could, you know, they could turn the dragon, which leads us into the final scene of the season in them kind of burning down the wall with their blue flame. It actually wasn't ice. I actually thought that was very prescient that you kind of said, does the dragon breathe ice or fire? Because the overall theme of ice and fire kind of hanging over the show. I actually got into an argument on Twitter.
What was that?
I think it was blue flame, but there's a lot of people who play World of Warcraft coming at me like, dude, it's this thing called arcane fire, which looks like fire, but is actually just this pure destructive magical force. And I was like, all right. Like.
Wait, explain that. What's it called? Arcane fire?
Arcane fire. So like Arcade Fire, the band, but replace the D with an N. It's just kind of like this weapon used in World of Warcraft that is blue, looks like fire, but is actually just this pure magical force. Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, whatever that was, it did the job.
All right, let's transition straight into the season finale, The Dragon and the Wolf. What an episode. I thought such a satisfying episode on so many levels, but it starts with this meeting in the dragon pit between Daenerys' camp and Cersei's camp. What a scene, you know, with the White kind of being kicked over by the Hound, charging straight at Cersei. Qyburn kind of being, like, totally lit up by the fact that there's this army of undead kind of marching on his Seven Kingdoms. And then kind of seeing, you know, Cersei kind of go back to the geopolitical game saying, I'll agree to this, but the King of the North can't take a side.
Yeah, I thought it was cool to see so many characters come together, really for the first time in the series. I mean, so many different characters whose plot lines have, you know, rubbed up against each other, but we haven't always seen them on the screen at the same time, or it's been a while since we've seen them together on the screen. And, you know, to bring Tyrion and Bronn back, to have, you know, Brienne and the Hound, Tyrion and Podrick, the Mountain and the Hound, I mean, all these different characters, you know, Daenerys and Cersei finally in the same room, Jon and Cersei. I thought that added to the gravity, that added to the tension. What I found, you know, to me, I think that was a great buildup, but I thought it also was great foreshadowing, because it reminds you of sort of the new allegiances that were formed and also of the old allegiances that existed at some point. And I think that, again, as I said at the very beginning of this podcast, that's going to be, I think, the big theme of season 8 is how do these allegiances hold up? Where do the loyalties of said individuals lie? We can get into that, but I thought the buildup for that was great. And then, you know, of course, Dani's got to make her grand entrance. You know, hey, I show up 15 minutes late, fashionably late, and, you know, sort of pulling up in a Lamborghini, I just kind of swoop in on Drogon.
One of the things that I really loved about this episode is that there was so much speculation going into it. We kind of all said that there's going to be a meeting with Cersei, Dany, Jon, Tyrion, Jaime. You kind of feel like them coming together has to produce bodies
right. Some
way. And what I loved about that episode was that they kind of entertained everybody's theory about who would die in that meeting. You know, at first it almost seems like Daenerys's camp is going to get ambushed and they're just going to get straight up slaughtered. And then you kind of have this idea that Cersei may get killed by the White in that, you know, that 30 seconds or so where she's being threatened by it. And then we kind of have that theory where Tyrion might get killed off when he kind of supposedly almost sacrifices himself for the good of the diplomacy by going into her office and kind of just talking her through it, saying, hey, I don't care if you kill me. This is a matter of beyond my own life or death. This is something that needs to be addressed. I'm willing to die for this cause.
I thought there was an interesting tell. It was subtle. I thought it was an interesting tell. The scene between Cersei and Tyrion and then later with Cersei and Jaime. And she has an opportunity to kill both of them. And she very easily could have. And she doesn't. And with Tyrion, I think you can kind of understand it. Yeah, she knows that if she kills him, Daenerys will probably just reduce King's Landing to rubble. If she doesn't kill him, then you're going to have, a potential enemy who continues to loom. But I think you also saw, hey, there might be a shred of humanity left in her. Or, you know, something, I mean, again, and we saw, I think, you know, when she was broken down and we've seen through the course of the show that she clearly loves her children. And maybe it's the protective motherly instinct coming back now that she's allegedly with child. But I think it maybe saw a shred of humanity left because, again, you know, she was very comfortable backstabbing, you know, the whole deal, the whole pact that they made with everybody. But she could have easily had, you know, Jaime and Tyrion killed. And probably in her mind was justified in doing so, but chose not to. So I think that – I thought that was an interesting tell, and I'm curious to see if that was just kind of a moment of weakness where maybe she felt she didn't have the leverage or if it was actually, sort of the last remnants of her humanity.
Yeah, that brings me greatly into my next two points. First of all, the meeting between Dany and Tyrion kind of ends with a lot of things – said off screen, obviously, because Tyrion does kind of seem to persuade her to kind of give up this notion that I need to have this conditional kind of truce with Daenerys. And she basically comes and says, hey, like, I'm willing to have this truce. I believe that you should look positively on me going forward, but I know that you won't. What could have happened between her and Tyrion in that unseen scene to kind of change her mind? And there's this theory kind of going around that maybe Tyrion just went up to her and said, this needs to end on good terms. You need to go back and tell them what they need to hear.
I could see that. You know, Tyrion's a diplomat. He's a politician. And I'm also wondering, you know, what happened to him coming out of there? I think both actors, I thought, have done a phenomenal job this season. And, you know, with Cersei, to just to go back a little more, you know, go back to the scene where Daenerys lands in the dragon pit riding Drogon. And then you see the look on Cersei's face as she dismounts and starts walking. And it's, hey, the younger, the more beautiful queen who's coming to take her place. And you can see there is this sense of fear. There's this sense of awe. There's a sense where Cersei's trying not to show it, but you can tell that she's intimidated by the, you know, sort of the power and the sway that this person has, who's been able to amass this army. And I think for Tyrion on the other side is, you know, when he goes back, he's reminded of who he is. He's reminded of where he came from. As much as he hates Cersei,
it's still his sister. And we know, you know, and again, there is humanity there. I mean, he's never wished his sister dead, even though she's wished him dead. Now, he obviously has taken up a side against her and wants to take her out of her position. But, you know, he's never actively tried to kill her before, unlike what she tried to do to him. I mean, she tried to have him executed, tried to have him killed at the Battle of Blackwater. And, you know, you kind of get that sense where, hey, I'm still a Lannister. And, you know, I think there's a little bit of doubt on Tyrion. You know, he's watched some of the things that Dany's on. I think there's a little bit of doubt. I'm not saying he's going to jump ship and switch sides, but I think there's a little bit of doubt as to, man, you know, did I cast my lot with the right person? I think there's a little bit of that. I know I'm not saying Cersei's the right person. She's absolutely not the right person, but you know, I think he's in a position now where he's kind of figuring out, hey, you know, I chose Dany because we could build a better world together. I'm wondering, maybe I'm having second thoughts about that, where if that's actually feasible.
Another scene that I really loved was the confrontation between Jaime and Cersei. My heart kind of sank at first when, you know, Cersei kind of, you know, tilted her head to signal Sir Gregor to kill him, but that was actually just kind of a bluff. And then he's like, I don't believe you, and walks off. That felt like a great kind of redemption arc, you know, point for him. Let's go to the Littlefinger scene, because that was one of the most rewarding points, it kind of felt like, of the season.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically, first of all, he had like the blinking guy meme face when Sansa accuses him of murder and treason. I was like, wow, this is awesome.
Yeah, that's going to turn into a great meme when, you know, when a team from, you know, the MAAC knocks off a number two seed in the NCAA tournament. That'll be a great wait. Well, what just happened? And, you know, to see him, the guy who has been the master puppeteer, get manipulated and get played. And the way it happened, you know, and this idea, hey, the lone wolf dies, but the pack lives. Just what a great payoff. And I thought there was, you know, to see it, the Starks who sort of orchestrated his demise, given all that he's done to the family and all the harm that he's done to the family. I mean, that was probably one of the most satisfying deaths we've had. I mean, we've had Joffrey, we've had Ramsay. I would probably say that might have been more satisfying than either of those.
Interesting. One thing I really loved about that scene was the acting from Aidan Gillen. He had to go out with a bang, and he really did, because in that scene, like, you hated Littlefinger so much and you were waiting for this comeuppance for so long. But in that scene, yeah, he was able to go from powerful to pathetic in really no time at all. And I actually kind of felt bad for him, because, like, here's a character who has really been disadvantaged from the beginning and has had to come a long way by very unsavory means, and he's finally kind of getting played. He was able to kind of turn you for a minute, but then I was like, nah, I hate this guy.
To me, that again is the genius of the show, is that even though he was villainous and full of treachery, he wasn't one-dimensional. I mean, there was a reason for his ambition. There was a reason for his intention. You know, you go back to his backstory. You know, he was a ward of the Tullys, and really had a crush on Catelyn Tully, who later became Catelyn Stark. It was love that, you know, really wasn't, it was unrequited love. So he ends up, you know, kind of settling for the older sister, but not allowed to marry her. And he comes from a smaller house and really had to fight and crap. He's nearly killed by Ned Stark's older brother when he wants Catelyn's hand and is challenged to a duel. And then she had been promised to Ned Stark's older brother, who's then burned by the Mad King. So Ned marries Catelyn. And this guy's sort of been through a lot. He's beaten down. He's had this giant boulder on his shoulder. And all of a sudden, it's kind of like, okay, well, I'll show you guys. I'll show the world. I'll show that I can rise and I can be somebody from a small house who can do great things. And, you know, those are the motivations for his ambition. It wasn't like this just started out of nowhere. There was a genesis to it. And but again, you know, he took it too far, and it was really nice to see him go, and it was nice that it was that dagger that did him in.
All right, let's get to kind of the climax of the episode. no pun intended, but basically Bran kind of revealing, well, first of all, it was a great scene that really only the show could perform well. This would not have translated well over the books, but Samwell and Bran meet. Bran is obviously very powerful, but this was an interesting point because it shows that he can see everything, but he doesn't know exactly where to look. And here comes Samwell with a bombshell, basically suggesting to him that there was this secret marriage between Rhaegar and Lyanna, and he's able to teleport in time to see that happen. That, I think, was a very interesting plot point to show that Bran can see everything, but he needs, you know, guidance to know where to look. And then it was just really right. interesting to kind of see this incest scene come together with him kind of narrating over it.
Isn't it incredible how the show is just normalized incest now? That's incest. Like, they've just kind of normalized it. It's been done.
It really has come full circle. Like, the episode one, we're like, ew, incest. And then, like, two, basically everybody's right. popping champagne that John and Danny are getting it on.
Oh, incest. Right. Yes. It's frightening and disgusting and completely normal now in this universe. You know, it's funny. The flashback I had in that Bran Sam scene, was, you've seen Little Giants, right?
Yeah.
So remember the kid who comes up with the annexation of Puerto Rico?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm thinking, I mean, that is the Bran Samwell role now in the show. They're not going to be icebox on the field. They're not going to be the guy breaking tackles, scoring touchdowns, but they are now the ones coming up with the plan. They are the annexation of Puerto Rico, of Westeros. They're the guy on the sideline. Hey, I've got a play that works. And how about the fact that the actor that they had who portrayed Rhaegar in Bran's vision there when he goes in the past, was that not the same guy who played Danny's older brother in season one who gets his head melted by gold by Khal Drogo?
It was not the same actor. I actually saw a still picture of what the guy looks like, but it was kind of disappointing to see him basically look the same way as Danny's older brother because we hate that guy so much.
Right. Right. You know, and again, I think the other thing that didn't, again, and this is nitpicking here, but so John's real name is Aegon. In the books, Rhaegar already had a son who was killed by the Mountain whose name was Aegon. So did he name both of his kids Aegon? Did he, I mean, his other kid would still be alive at that point. Did he have two kids named Aegon? That would be weird.
I think that builds into the whole, like, Azor Ahai, ice and fire prophecy that he kind of bought into. Like, he said, oh, maybe this is the child that is going to be, you know, the savior of our land. I'm going to name him Aegon as well.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned there is significance to that. You know, Aegon the Conqueror was the first one who came over, you know, the first dragon lord to kind of come over to Westeros with the, you know, his two sister wives, again, to normalize incest even further. And they kind of conquered Westeros and started the whole Targaryen dynasty. So, you know, a little bit of symmetry there. But, you know, again, I walked away, Dan, from season eight, and I said to myself, okay, you know, to keep going back to allegiances, you know, Dany's become a little power hungry. How does she reconcile her ambition with now the knowledge of who John really is? I'm sure that is something that she'll find out very soon. The other allegiances, Cersei and Jaime, you know, how does Jaime reconcile his allegiance to Cersei? Because up until now, anything noble that he's had to do or he wants to do, she's pulled him back to the dark side. Can she pull him back to the dark side once more? If he's confronted with her once more, will she get him to come back to him? Because again, he's, you know, they've had their sort of falling outs, you know, throughout the course of the show, and she's always managed to pull him back into the fold. But if it's, you know, Jaime now going north, would he take Cersei's side over, let's say, the Stark sisters or over Brienne? And you kind of have all these different allegiances playing out. It's the Starks at Winterfell against Dany potentially coming back as a Targaryen family that you know, had their grandfather killed and their uncle killed. So I think these little allegiances that we have now, the Hound and the Mountain, you know, how do they play out? How do they reconcile them? I mean,
I'm really curious about it. And I think that's kind of the crux of season 8 is that, you know, what side do you ultimately fall down? Is it self-preservation? Is it humanity? Is it somebody that you trusted once or that you were close to once, but have drifted away from? And do you go onto the new path? Look at Tyrion. You know, is he still a Lannister? Does he take the side of Dany? Maybe I think Jon Snow is the, you know, makes for the best leader. I think all those questions now come into focus, come into play. And, you know, I think that along with the, you know, the fight for humanity and survival sort of become the crux of what we were going to expect. 2019, is it?
I guess so. I believe I heard a figure of 18 months is the projected wait time, so to speak.
It's a long time.
Yeah. I was actually like thinking, I was like, man, I got to take care of myself. I got to be around for that.
Right.
But that John and Danny scene kind of transitions well into the overall questions going forward, because in that scene, Tyrion is eavesdropping on them, and you can kind of see that he's disappointed with what is happening. I feel like that was very much left to interpretation, and
I think he got Mormonted. I think he got Jorah'd. He got Mormonted. You know,
you think he got friend-zoned?
I think he got friend-zoned. I think there was a little longing there, and then I think there was a little, I think I've got a chance, maybe. I think there's something here. There's a kindred spirit, and really, you're gonna take this guy, and I think there was some disappointment.
Interesting. I there's a few theories that I'm kind of thinking of. One, the one that seems the most plausible to me is that Danny and John kind of falling in love really makes things more complicated than they need to be, and he kind of knows that counseling Daenerys going forward is going to be tough because he's got his own kind of, you know, counsel to give her, and then she's also going to go to John. And like we've mentioned earlier in the show, John isn't exactly the best decision maker. So he's kind of,
the worst. He's arguably the worst.
But he sucks at dying, so it kind of works out well for him.
Right, but he gets other people killed, unfortunately. Well, you know, here's my takeaway from that scene, and this was foreshadowed the entire season. What did we constantly hear from Danny all season long? The dragons are my children. The dragons are my children. I've been told I can never have children. I've got a feeling that may change. They were pretty explicit about that, no pun intended, and speaking quite literally. And so, I mean, isn't that what we're expecting here, where it's Danny, it's John, and we've been told she can't have kids. She can't have kids. The dragons are her kids. She lost a kid, you know, she lost a dragon, and you know, this is what the witch told me. And, you know, John says, you know, well, maybe it wasn't the best source. And now John and Danny, you know, get naked. And you're going to tell me that, you know, season 8, we're not going to find out at some point that Danny's with child.
Very, very interesting take. I like that. I think that's definitely one of the things up in the air. Let's move on to my second question, which we kind of, you know, hinted at earlier in the show. And that this was actually something I don't think I even thought about until I saw the wall coming down. But what is the motive of the Night King and his army of the dead? And what really actually scared me was, what if there isn't a motive? What if this is just this mindless force that is just descent on destroying all that lives?
I don't buy the latter. I do agree with you. There is a motive, and it's been kept hidden from us. It's been kept hidden from the civilization that's set in the show's universe. And I, you know, kind of look at it again. Everybody in this show, everybody in the books is shaded in some shade of gray.
Yeah.
There's nuance to everybody. You know, we don't have these, it's not the classic fantasy where there's good, there's evil. You know, everyone's got a little bit of good, a little bit of evil. Everybody's made good decisions and bad decisions, and they've got their motivations for how they act. But the Night King and his army, though, that has been the one sort of, okay, this is the pure evil that exists. And we saw how they were created, right? They were essentially created in the beginning to protect the children of the forest from mankind. And, you know, you take a step back and you start to zoom out and you say, well, you know, look at the destruction that that mankind has rained on each other.
Yeah.
You know, Danny wiping out hordes of people with her dragons and crucifying the masters and the evil that Cersei has done, and Littlefinger and Joffrey, and Ramsay. Is he that much worse? What's his purpose? And I do think that we are going to find that there is a purpose. There's something going on there. And I think Bran probably ends up being the one to show us that, because he can go into the past. Now, why do they wait so long? You know, were they waiting 1,000 years just so they can get a dragon and you know, break through the wall? I think anybody who's watched the show knew at some point the wall was coming down. I mean, you don't put up that, you know, massive spectacle you know, continue to tell people, oh, the wall's been up for centuries and millennia and it's made of magic. You know, you keep saying that, and it means at some point it's going to come down. They're able to finally breach the wall. They're coming south. But I do think they have to have a why. I think actually if they don't have a why, it's bad storytelling.
Very good point. I, you know, going forward, I think the Night King and the Army of the Dead's motive might be the reveal of the entire show. It could be somewhere along with the whole like idea of the Azor Ahai, kind of like resurrected prophecy king and all that kind of stuff.
What if the Night King is Azor Ahai?
I mean, I think that's a plausible theory all around. Like, it's going
to
be interesting.
I want to come back to this. What you said earlier, you said you read a theory that Bran is the Night King. Explain that to people, how Bran could be the Night King.
So this was a very Twitter-esque take. It was, you know, most of my kind of crazy fan theories come from Reddit, because I'm a big-time peruser of r/A Song of Ice and Fire and r/Game of Thrones. This one I saw on Twitter, but it originated from a post on Reddit basically kind of saying that since Bran can, like, warg into certain creatures, that he's going to try to warg into maybe the Night King or something like that. And the Night King actually sets a trap for him, kind of like along the lines of what happened with the Hodor scene. And basically that Bran is going to become the Night King. And then that actually led me to my own theory that maybe the Night King...
So his consciousness is trapped essentially inside.
Yes. And that actually led me to maybe think that maybe the Night King is going south purposely to kill Bran, to kind of stop all of this from happening. It's kind of like the going back in time, you know, to kill off the parents kind of storyline. It's a wild one.
Okay, I'll give you my theory. I think the way it ends, I think we do find out what the Night King's motive is. And I think Bran, we're told Bran will fly, right? So that means, I see that as he's not going to physically be on one of the dragons. He's going to warg into one of the dragons. With the Night King riding the dragon, what if Bran can warg into the ice dragon and basically turn that ice dragon into a kamikaze plane and take down the Night King with
it? I've read that theory. I love that theory. I think that's totally plausible going forward. We could talk about this all day. I think we gotta bring it in for a landing, so to speak.
This was fun, Dan. Yeah, this was
fun. Got a coach's call, you know, in about an hour. I got to get back to work, but it's, you know, kind of behind the scenes, you know, we talk about Game of Thrones probably on a weekly basis via text. So we definitely, you know, stay up with this and kind of really make it the crux of our week discussing it. So it's kind of fun.
How many people end up listening to this? I'm curious. How many people actually end up listening to this on a lacrosse podcast?
I don't know, man. There's a lot of...
There's going to be, you're going to see some comments like, wait a minute, I meant to open up a lacrosse podcast.
This is the Inside Lacrosse Off Topic podcast centered around Game of Thrones. And I like to think that in terms of lacrosse world and lacrosse Twitter, that we are the ultimate voices on Game of Thrones. What do you think about that?
I'll sign up for that. You know what we may have to do? I may have to see, maybe we can come in costume for a game next year. We got to get Quint on board. Kark would do it. I got to find a way to get Quint on board. If I can get Quint on board, I think that'd be fun.
Will there be another Game of Thrones broadcast?
Show up as a clan of Night's Watchmen or something. But Quint would take convincing. I can get Kark to do it. Quint would take convincing.
Well, everyone, stay tuned. Maybe there will be a Game of Thrones, Night's Watch kind of themed outfit kind of broadcast coming our way. But I'm Dan Abern. I want to give a whole bunch of thanks to Anish Shroff for joining us. We hope you guys enjoyed the Inside Lacrosse Off-Topic podcast. We would love to discuss this on social media, so hit us up. But thank you for listening.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.